you'll be able to point me to maybe somebody that does. So how did you get started in sports economics?
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah.
I mean, just briefly.
No, I understand. It's so there's kind of two different paths. One is when I really started teaching it, and it had more to do with it wasn't really my dissertation, right? But
Right.
when I started at UTA, who they desperately needed was someone to teach that topic. It's one of those where sports economics is it's a very popular class,
Okay.
even though it might not translate very well overall into the economy, right? So it was a very popular class, and they didn't want to lose it. And so
Okay.
they asked me, and it's like, well, could you teach this? Like, well, yeah, I could teach this. I mean, it's really fundamentals and
Right,
intermediate econ, but just on looking at these sports
it's
topics.
using sports topics to teach economics,
Yes,
essentially.
it's definitely an econ course in the economics format. Now, that's kind of like how we really started teaching it and learning, a lot of the basic principles happening with things like, so I would learn some basic stuff of labor. But then I started doing research in it, where there was a PhD student at UTA, one of the, actually, you might know him. It's, any of the management PhD students at all when you were there, anything like that?
I was
A guy
like,
named Ryan Terry.
nope. I was like,
Okay.
I only ran across the finance PhD students.
Okay. Well, anyway, he. And this is kind of true of a lot of the management ones. He had this data set. It was a sports data set, right? And what he's studying is that he's studying from a management perspective, where he's using these sports data set, this the sports that these sports data sets to explore larger, let's say, labor topics that are close to, let's say, a lot of the labor econ type research that they do,
Okay.
right? And the reason sports is valuable is because it's very easy to judge performance of the individual in sport like baseball, right?
Right.
It's like runs and batting
Right.
average, and
There's
that's the right.
easily measurable outputs.
Yes, right. And that's not much. That's not nearly as evident when it comes to let's say like a manager,
Yeah,
right?
it's
I
like,
mean,
or like at my job, where it's like, well, I write articles, but or like, how do you measure the performance there?
sure, 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 sure. You can maybe measure reach in some way, but yeah, it's a lot more difficult. And so I started doing a lot of the analytics. And he needed somebody. He had decent ideas, but he really needed somebody to really think of it from an economic perspective. And he definitely needed somebody who could perform data analysis, right? And so it's like, okay, so if you're going to do this, here's the model you would have to set up, and in order to explore this question, right, to make sure that the analysis you're doing is actually reflective of the question you're trying to ask, right? And so that's how I got into it, right? And so then I got a paper out, and we got another paper we're going to be submitting here in labor econ. Well, in management journals, but it'll be basically on labor economics from the sports angle.
I imagine that it would also be, and this is completely off topic for what I'm here for, but it would be a good way to measure the effectiveness of, say, unions, because
Sure.
there,
Yeah.
I was like, it's one of the few places where like rich people get to unionize. Now you mentioned something about price di or not price differ prize differentials
Yeah.
and that affecting performance outcomes. Can you talk to me about that a
What's
little
going
bit?
on with that? Okay,
Yeah.
so they view a lot of these tournaments here. Let me just throw it up here.
Okay.
This would be, and it's somewhat like the reason they do this. Where's my dummy? Was that an eraser? Surely I got an eraser somewhere, didn't
You would think.
I? Yeah, it's kind of pointless to have a.
But then again, maybe you've only
Maybe
written
I
on it
know.
once.
No, I promise. I tend to be. Oh, here. I tell you what. Let me grab a paper towel here.
Sure.
So in those tournament type settings, right, it's the pay structure is usually like people do like seeing high quality tennis, right?
Correct.
But, you know, what will happen is that you may have two people that are darn near equivalent in terms of ability, right? Like,
okay.
Like, let's say in tennis, somebody who wins 3 sets to 2 and one of the sets goes into many extra rounds. I don't know the exact term for it. But the person who gets first has a much higher, let's say, payoff versus
correct.
Second, even though in terms of their overall absolute ability, they're probably really close.
Okay, right? Yeah, because I think if you look at something like the Irving Tennis Classic, second place gets, I want to say, like $11,000, and first place gets $21,000 or something.
Yeah, and that doubling up, that ratio of, let's say, going a half lower each rank you go down, that's pretty common in a lot of sports contests. Right?
Okay.
I don't know if they felt that was kind of clean, but like the Masters in golf, it's kind of the same thing.
I think they probably do feel it's clean because they have these powers of two as far as like the, especially in tennis tournaments, like the number of people that make it to the next round. Like they're starting with 64 people and then they have 32, so they're like, well, we can pay them double or something.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, maybe that's the case. Well, but they don't necessarily pay on a per. Well, okay, I see what you're saying, right? And then they try to divvy it up. But in terms of the tournament structure, why they do this, it's to try to have the spacing to induce, it's the spacing of the payoffs that plays a critical role in the amount of effort that people are going to, let's say, expend, right? And there's a fair amount of empirical evidence that says that too. Not a ton, but some. And it has to do with thinking of, let's say, here's a graph, and let's say effort, remember, look at my notes when I did this. Let's say effort is on, let's say, this x-axis.
Uh-huh.
Let's say the marginal cost of effort is on the y-axis.
Okay.
Right? The how personally costly it is, right? And so for each incremental unit of effort in terms of a given sport, right, has an increasing, let's say, marginal cost in the sense that the more and more effort I put in, that means I'm basically can't do other things, right? I'm giving up.
Right.
You can maybe view it as somewhat like leisure, right?
But there's diminishing marginal returns to your effort. Or in this case, you're saying exponential cost.
That's true, but I'm just looking at it from a cost perspective.
Okay.
Right? From the sense of what, in terms of benefits, you can maybe think of what you're foregoing, right? If I'm practicing tennis 20 hours a day, right, that 19th of that 20th hour, I'm really giving up, let's say, some serious things versus, let's say, the first hour to the second hour.
Right. Okay.
So you view this relationship like this.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
The marginal cost. Now, you're, as the tournament organizer, you get paid when people are playing tennis well, right? The quality of tennis really matters, okay? And so you need to make sure you induce people in such a way as to, let's say, maximize the amount of effort that they're going to go ahead and provide, okay? So let's say you did the opposite. Let's say you just had, you know, first was only marginally, got marginally more of a payoff, and the second marginally more here. And let's say those individuals are looking at that sort of situation. Well, if the rewards were all kind of the same, okay, and all these individuals are looking at this situation, they're saying, well, I would want to maximize my reward, if you want to view this as, let's say, the reward is, like, let's say, revenue. If I want to maximize this amount of difference, and there's a bunch of people, let's say, applying this craft, you're saying, well, do I really want to, let's say, operate here at this high level of effort when I can maybe operate at a much lower level of effort and get only a slightly different, let's say, reward that comes from it?
Right. Okay.
Right?
I got you.
And so because of that, you know, these organizers realize this, saying, well, if we're going to actually do these rewards to maximize the amount of the effort, what we need to do is that we need to go ahead and, instead of having everyone at the same, we need to say, okay, so first place, if you want to view this as, let's say, the marginal revenue of getting first, maybe up here, and maybe have the marginal revenue of, let's say, getting second, let's say, here. But now people are looking at this from a standpoint of, well, if this is the kind of marginal revenue that I want to go ahead and be able to achieve, right, I know I have to be first in order to be able to get to this, so I'm going to go ahead and maximize a huge amount of effort to make sure I win, because if I don't win and get second, my payoff is much, much, much less. Right?
Okay. Yep.
And so this difference, right, especially it's the difference that really maximizes, is really what helps maximize. I mean, number one, the absolute level of the reward matters too, but those differences are really driving why people drive tons of,
right, of course,
effort into it.
So that if the tournament, because one thing I've read is that only the, say, top 350 players actually break even on playing
chess. Yes, and you have a bunch of them who are just actually losing, right?
Right.
Now,
and so that if the payoffs were closer, then people would just play to get the amount of money that they need for a particular tournament and kind of drop out, because as you continue playing, A, you have to expend more effort, but B, there's more of a risk of injury. There's, like you said, increasing costs as you continue. So as soon as you get the prize money that you need, just stop.
Yeah.
And so I could see how, like, well, if you spread it out more and you make it
I
so
see.
That...
You stay in the game until the big payoff, right?
Until the payoff that you need, right, yeah.
Now, is that what we're seeing, or do you think it's people who are... And I'm guessing a lot of these players typically come from relatively well-financed backgrounds. So even though they're technically... in of themselves losing money, they have a reserve they can pull from that still allows them to compete in tennis regularly and things like this.
That's quite possible. Yeah. Based on, I don't know, I don't have information specifically, well, I might have it on players, but I know for tennis fans, like the median income is something like $80,000 a year, whereas the median household income for the U.S. is like 50, so it's...
Sure, okay. And so it kind of...
So if fans,
parallel, that maybe if the fans are like that, maybe the
players are very similar.
Someone like that as well.
In fact, it's probably very true, at least in the United States. And we are trying to make this a global report, but in the United States, I know for certain that 90% of the spending that happens in the tennis economy comes from people that play 10 times a year or more. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I mean. They're obviously not professional players, but they're players nonetheless, and
yeah.
So
that has like a that's interesting on that how some sports really rely on the people's, like, it's almost like it requires the experience of the sport to drive the demand for it, right?
Right.
Versus kind of like maybe like a football, which like the football maybe does a better job of selling itself. I don't know
right.
if it's really quite true, but
the idea I think holds is that. There are some sports where the spectating is great, and you, like, I haven't played football in 15 years.
Sure, yeah.
But I've certainly continued to watch it, whereas I've certainly played tennis in the last year, but I haven't necessarily watched it. So I think that could be a good point.
Yeah, and I imagine too that there is a, in terms of behavioral factors, there is that thrill. It's that winner's curse idea that may be playing some level of role, some role in this, in that. Well, there's actually maybe a couple things, right? Because people's inherent competitive nature may want to keep them in the game. And there's a lot of behavioral research
right.
on that especially among same sex, when I'm, let's say, in a competition of, and this is true of male and female, especially, if you're a guy, it doesn't matter who you're partnered with. But if women are in, let's say, female-only competitions, right,
mm-hmm.
there's a ton of evidence that shows that people massively overcompete relative to their actual ability level. Now, maybe not, it hasn't been tested in sports, but it's been tested in mathematical ability.
Okay.
Right, where, and even
so, you're saying that if there's a math competition that's strictly for girls and women, that how do you measure over competing?
Okay, so I'll explain it, because it's interesting stuff. So what they do is that they say they'll give subjects a piece rate task, saying for every, and this is experimental stuff, like in a lab,
mm-hmm.
for every math question you get right, we'll give you 50 cents, right? And it'll be timed. Right, so there's an incentive to try to do as absolutely many as you can, right,
mm-hmm.
in order to maximize your earnings. And so then what they do is that they show everyone the results, right? Maybe not names, so if we're in the same room, I don't know that this person is specifically you, but I know that there's somebody out here with this performance level.
Mm-hmm.
And they show them the rank,
and they say, okay, so this is how everyone did in this group, right? And then they give the subjects a choice. And they said, okay, so we'll let you do this. We'll let you go ahead and engage in the same piece rate, let's say, situation for a certain amount of time, right? Or you can enter, you can be entered in this contest where the winner gets this large payoff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but if you're not the winner, you don't get anything. Now, if you're looking at this and you're looking from a standpoint of, okay, I didn't do very well. I in this piece rate task,
okay,
I got like second to last, right? Clearly, it should, you know, you would think from a rational perspective, I should look at this from a standpoint that my chance of winning this
is very, very low,
right? But for some reason, people still do it.
Okay.
Right? And they, I mean, not everybody. The very, very poor people may kind of, the poor performers may get it. But even if you're halfway,
right,
the chance of you winning is incredibly low.
Right. Right?
But still, especially guys and especially men, predominantly go into this contest setting, right? And it's incentivized. This is real money they're talking about, especially for students where, you know, earning $20 is really salient to them, right? And they'll still, let's say, engage in these competitive situations, right?
Even though
it would make far more sense for them to do.
Right, the expected value of doing the piecemeal thing is another $5, but the expected value of the competition in reality is probably like $1.50 cents.
If honestly, it's probably pennies, because while the ability to win, maybe it's a $30 payoff, but your probability of victory is probably so low, it's probably maybe 1%.
Right.
So it's literally 1 or 2%, so it's like 50 cents.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you really have to be lucky in order to be able to get that. But people still
go for it.
That, right.
Interesting.
And this is when they're controlling for people's disposition for risk, right? It's not like this is a risk story where risk-seeking individuals are doing that. They try to account for that as much as they can with other settings. They control for their level of risk. Remember, in econometrics, they would control for that as a covariate, right?
Right.
Really zero in. Okay, what's going on with these individuals, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they find that. And women will behave similarly if they're in a room that they know is with other women. But if it's intermixed, men still behave the same way. But if it's across genders, women, when they're competing against men, bow out at much higher rates. They don't want to compete against men.
They
right?
don't. So
they're competitive. For some reason, it's just alleviated.
I was like, the question is, are they becoming more rational, or are they just less over-competitive?
Well, okay, so I think the argument primarily is this, is that all in all, in a mixed setting, women, the issue, and you're right to bring this up, it's not so much that women need to compete more, it's men that need to compete less for their own benefit, right? But women exhibit many of the same traits. I'll have to dig up this research for you. Especially there's one guy who is actually a PhD student from Oregon, but I'm not sure where he went. But he found that when women are by themselves, then they start exhibiting this desire, this competitive desire, in a similar manner to men. Maybe not quite as much, but they're much more willing to compete, even though their performance is relatively pedestrian.
Okay. I'd be interested in the sample size of those two.
In terms of people?
Yeah.
Well, you think in most experiments, you're probably talking about per blocking the experiment, you're probably talking 40, 50 people per block, so I wouldn't be surprised if you're talking upwards 100, 150 people.
Okay.
Right? That's about for total. That's pretty status quo.
Okay.
Experimental work.
All right. That gets us to the question about differences in prize payouts. What were you mentioning in terms of sponsorships with Serena Williams?
Oh, about how... I think the only thing to mention there would be how, even though she's incredibly dominant in the sport, and I would bring this up in the class, that her dominance in tennis dwarfs the dominance of almost any other male in any other sport. But one thing that may explain why she's like 20th on the endorsement list overall, right? And she's not like first, because it's just basically a demand story, that the demand for tennis, right, and the reach of tennis stars to be able to, let's say, sell certain other products is quite a bit, say, less than than what, you know, let's say, like a good basketball player, but not a great basketball player. Like,
mm-hmm.
Who would be one that's not viewed as the best, but still good? Like a, gosh, I don't know.
Doesn't matter who you name. I'm not going to know who you're talking about.
But you know what I'm getting at, right? And so the man plays a role. There is probably maybe a discrimination role. This is always hard to really tease out because not only is she behind, you know, the big stars, and I think a lot of that is because of tennis's popularity as much, but she's also behind, especially 5 years ago when we were talking about this, that Shapira Navratilova, that Russian player or whatever,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though she clearly, performance-wise, is better, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people debate, is this a taste-based discrimination, right? That people, you know, they don't feel that, you know, an African-American tennis player could sell their watch nearly as well as the super hot white one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you start talking about, well, Navratilova, it's the tennis thing is part of it, but it's probably interaction of tennis ability and beauty, right?
Right.
And I think most people would probably argue that she because of this interaction of the two, that would put her as a more attractive, let's say,
sponsor,
attractive being,
right?
More able to, let's say, sell the good versus
right. I was like attractive in the pecuniary sense, where you're talking about how much money this entity can make,
right?
Yeah.
Where then it's not necessarily a straight racism argument per se,
right?
Right. But, you know, I mean, there's certainly that's possible, too. That,
mm-hmm.
You know.
And, okay, piggybacking on that then, so there, I guess there could also be an argument made for just relative popularity. For example, tennis is like the sixth or seventh most popular sport in the United States, but it's the fourth most popular sport worldwide.
Sure.
But the United States is like the biggest economy, so there's, if you want to endorse somebody, you want them to be able to sell stuff in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
So there's, I guess there's that angle.
Yeah, that would be interesting because it's, I mean, the first thing that always comes to mind would be some sort of nationalistic appeal, right? That,
and,
you know, but
from what I've seen, there is a lot of that as far as, say, like, television ratings for a particular event. Like, if someone from that country is playing, people will watch.
Yeah.
And if they're not, they won't. Mm-hmm. Or they won't watch as much. You don't get the extra people in, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we were just talking with the head of the French Federation of Tennis. They put on the French Open, and he's a guy that gets all the, he's head of like ticket sales and hospitality, and that was one thing he mentioned, was like, for France, they, if they really want high ratings or more revenue, they essentially need a homegrown hero, but there aren't any currently, so it's their goal then is to like try and grow one.
Now, admittedly, even without the homegrown hero, they, you know, it's still an active sport.
It's drive. Actually still very popular in France.
Yeah, right. You know what I'm saying? Like, even their base level, in terms of that there's no Frenchman anywhere, right? I mean, they're still, their base level still like an active sport, which is still like an active business and things like that, right?
Yeah.
Right, and so it's the tennis, at least on that level, the tennis in of itself sells itself to some extent, right? It's just that incremental increase in demand really can change if it's a homegrown person, like you said.
Right. One thing that he actually mentioned is something I hadn't considered, and you might know a little bit about this or maybe the economics behind it, but they have. So they obviously sell the rights to broadcast the French Open, right? And
okay.
And any of the Grand Slams sells their rights to broadcast their event. But now there's a technology that kind of exists, or even without newer technology, you have the ability to sell the rights to, like, paid television broadcasters instead of free television broadcasters, right?
Okay. Yeah.
But the issue with that, you can make more money in the broadcast area there, but then that probably shrinks the amount of people that get to see it, which then shrinks the amount of revenue that you get from sponsors.
Yeah.
So.
But to name, that's interesting, right? Just to kind of think about what actually would be the smart path to go.
Yeah, right. What's the, how do you find the equilibrium?
Yeah. Or just how do you find what's optimal, right?
Right.
You have two different strategies, which one's going to give you a bigger bang.
Right.
For the buck, I guess, you know?
And what I really found interesting was about with regard to ticket prices, because I've seen a lot of information about the like prices on the secondary market, and how much more they are than on the than what they are face value. I'm like, that's an indication to me that you should increase your ticket prices because people are willing to pay for them. But almost no one is willing to do it except maybe the U.S. Open. Because they have this idea that they don't want to seem elitist,
yeah.
Because that will somehow hurt them, and that I suppose it's rational, but it feels irrational to me. I'm like,
yeah, well, you're right. And then even if it's the case, well, I mean, how much of an imbalance? How do you quantify that, right?
Right.
And I feel like it's almost. I mean, it's possible it's out there, but is this something that...
It's like you can see that people are willing to pay these prices, and no one's, like, claiming that you're elitist because other, like...
Other people are monetizing that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then it's like, then why allow the middleman to take a cut when you can just take the cut yourself?
You know what's funny is that I think... Yeah, it's almost like... I don't know how to get away with it. And I don't know if it's maybe because people don't quite get it. But you're right. It's like, well, if there's an active secondary market, that almost screams that they're not pricing right.
Yeah.
Right? And it does kind of seem like people will blame, like, I will blame the U.S. Tennis Federation for price gouging, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost like the secondary market, we just acknowledge, well, that's just the market, right? Blah, 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 blah. Even though I feel in many ways... A lot of times, these secondary markets are still heavily concentrated individuals, right? There's this
right.
one firm or one individual
that's
doing
just
this.
Buying a bunch of tickets and then selling them at market value.
And maybe that's it, is that they just, it's a lot more clear-cut in people's minds that, like, selling tickets in the U.S. Open is, and if it's really high prices, that's a monopolistic activity, right? That needs to stop, it's price gouging, blah, 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 right? Versus we just have in our head that, we even call it a secondary market, right? Even though it may be very far from anything.
It's like, which is kind of it's a nice way of saying a black market, right? Like, I mean, in the U.S., it might actually be illegal.
It's legal, but...
In England, it's not, though. You can legally resell your Wimbledon tickets. It's against the...
Oh, really?
It's against the tournament policy, it's not illegal to do.
Okay, but okay, so it is somewhat black market in terms of, that you're... Something seedy is happening. Right. It's funny in economics. It's almost like these ideas of formal versus black markets almost kind of get. It's almost like, well, they're still just markets, right? It's just one's kind of running out sector of some sort of typical politician that gives a blessing versus, let's say, one that doesn't. But it's the same mechanism for the most part. But why do they think that way? You know, I don't know why. I do believe, though, in general in sports. I wonder if you think this way too. That there is some sort of awakening of just how much market power there is on events like this, or like special events, or even teams and things like that. Because people always talk about, oh, their college football, the attendance is decreasing in college football. And it's funny because there's like so many articles I'll read, and they'll talk about football's decline in attendance, and they'll never even talk about price. It's like, it's price. They're raising higher prices. And people would maybe say, well, they're doing something wrong. They want to get more people in the stands. It's like, well, yeah, but they also want to make sure this price is really high.
Right.
They could have every single stadium could be packed to the brim. All they have to do, lower price.
Right.
They don't want to do that.
No, they're actually... Right. They're looking to maximize profit. And they're like,
profit,
if we can get to 96% capacity, great. We've priced exactly right.
Almost exactly right.
Even
be less, technically. Right. Like the Rangers aren't looking for capacity; they're looking for it might even be 60% capacity, but they know that at that price point, they'll get a certain quantity that will maximize their profit. Right.
Which is, something I want to know about the economics of these lower, like, tier tennis tournaments that happen. Like, there are two here in Dallas. There's the, I think, the RBC Championships, and then there's the Irving Tennis Classic. And I did an economic impact study for the Irving Tennis Classic, so they gave me, like, ticket sales. And I can tell you that, and I know the prize money that's given out, and they made something like $250,000, almost $250,000 in ticket sales, but they had to give out $150,000 in prize money.
Sure.
So that leaves $100,000 left to cover everything else. Yeah. And from what I've gathered from other people we interviewed, it's actually not a lucrative practice to run these tennis tournaments.
I bet that's probably true. I bet it maybe is it a bit of a prestige thing, right?
Like, I think so.
Because you have the members who are wealthy themselves, and they're like, well, if we don't make money on it, at least we have a tournament, and I get to see something in my hometown with this Steve-O famous players that attended, right? And
yeah.
If it's not the super elite. And so.
Yeah, I think at least for the stuff that I downloaded recently, I think their last tournament, the highest ranked person was like rank 40, which is good. Mm-hmm. Somebody that would play in the, you know, the major Grand Slams, but it, you know, it's not a top 10 or top 20 player.
Sure.
And I think even then, I don't. So
well, do they get government money too? Like, does the city of Irving
pitch in? That's actually what the whole economic impact survey was or study was about, was that the government will forego state sales taxes if you can prove that there's going to be this much economic activity because of the event.
Yeah.
So I think in the end for that tournament, I think it was like $8,000 of deferred sales taxes or something that they were eligible for. So yes and no.
Yeah, small.
And what I've found is that, or at least from the interviews that we've conducted, that their biggest expense is apparently the umpires, because the umpires get paid for all of these events, and like their travel is paid for and the hotel rooms are paid for. So it's like it's a big thing, and I was surprised because the players, like, they can, like, travel here and spend money on a hotel room and get nothing, like, if they lose in the first round, so.
That's interesting, because it almost makes you think that maybe as things become more automated in the officiating, that may actually change the overall calculus of some of these, that maybe it would actually mean that there could be an increase in the actual quantity of these things being supplied, because it's like, well, if I can save this on officiating, maybe now these things... Maybe a smaller town, I don't know, like McKinney, Texas, maybe. Decides to do it because of it.
So, actually, at least in the United States, I think that the smaller towns, not incredibly small, but the small-ish towns are probably better suited for some of these tennis events. Mm-hmm. Because if you try and put on, say, a challenger tour or event in Los Angeles, nobody wants to go, because in Los Angeles there's lots of stuff to do, and who wants to go see people in the low ranked in the low hundreds play a tennis tournament, right?
And pride of place, right? I mean, a lower tournament, you're not going to be proud that your town has a lower level tennis tournament in Los Angeles, but if you're in Lincoln, Nebraska, that might be kind of an identifying trait.
Right. So we have the Lincoln Masters tournament or whatever. Yeah. Exactly. We did talk about the difference in sponsorship between genders with Serena Williams. One of the things in tennis is equal pay between the two genders, and the prize money has been equal, at least in the major tournaments, since 2005, which is, I think, unique among sports.
It is. I think it is. I think you're right.
And
it seems to be, that seems to be some sort of, let's say, ethical stance that would, I would say, run kind of contrary to...
Mm-hmm.
Economic reasoning.
Right. Well, not necessarily.
Okay, if you think that you can maybe drum up increased demand because you do that.
Well, no, not because of that. Just that if you look at, say, Grand Slam Finals, where Serena Williams plays, the viewership is higher than that of the men's finals, unless, Roger Federer or Nadal is playing, or Djokovic. So there have been times when the women's finals have a bigger crowd. No, what's funny is actually that because of the equal pay, women actually make more per game, because in the women's tournaments they play best of three, and in the men's tournaments it's best of five. So men are playing for the same amount of money, but they're playing more games. But in tennis, there's this, for some reason, still this question, should men and women be paid the same? And so, like you said, there's, this ethical kind of drive, if it's not necessarily economically driven. But then there is some push for more of a pragmatic, I guess, is the best way to put it, tribe of having purses be based more on the amount of revenue they generate.
Sure.
Which, you know, in the cases where the women have a bigger draw, then they get paid more.
Sure.
But then the question then would become, if there are some places where women have a bigger draw, then why is there such a big difference in the amount of sponsorships between men and women?
Between men and women, and with looking specifically at tennis.
At tennis, yes.
And do men make a lot more in sponsorships, or the other way around?
No, I think it's men make a lot more in sponsorships, I don't have good hard data on that. I have a former tennis player, top tennis player, that has told us there's a big difference.
In terms of sponsorships.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you said that. So, if you were to look at this, and it's hard to do this because it's... So, you know, when we talk in sports, just to use, let's say, leagues again, a lot of times we'll talk about the NBA being player-driven, that it's the players in of themselves that have a huge factor in, let's say, demand. People want to see certain players, right?
Right, people want to see Steph Curry even if the Warriors aren't winning.
Yes, or if he's on another team or something like that, right? Okay, versus, let's say, football is kind of viewed as really being the team brand, right?
Right.
And so that makes it hard in the sense that, you're right, I think tennis probably has that component, like you said earlier, about watching when Serena Williams is playing, they're watching because of her, right? Not necessarily the tennis in of itself doesn't, there's at least some change, some people who are impacted by that. So when it comes to men versus women, when you say that one has a bigger draw than the other, I was under the impression that worldwide, the demand for men's tennis is much greater than women's tennis.
I think that's probably true.
In the U.S. specifically, that might be reversed, right?
Yes. And in some other countries that also may be reversed. More depending on who's playing. So if there's a Japanese women's player playing in the finals, you're gonna have a bigger draw for the women's finals in Japan, right?
So what I'm wondering on the sponsorship, because I'm guessing it's luxury goods, right?
For the most part, yes.
Right? These are probably firms that sell. They're probably not overly competitive markets, and they sell, across basically the wealthy countries of the world, right?
Right, because it's not Anheuser-Busch, it's not, it's Ford Motor, it's Rolex.
Right,
It's Deloitte.
Consulting, right? Yeah, right. And so I'm just thinking in terms of this that, well, if this is really the case, and if many of these, if...
So you think it might be a fan bias? The people we're selling to are typically men, so we're probably going to, they're probably going to watch men's tennis, so that's where we want to do our sponsorships?
Yeah, or maybe that let's see, let's say for like a Serena, giving to this idea that the sponsorship for men is great, much greater than the sponsorship for women controlling for ability, right?
Controlling for relative ability, anyway.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Relative ability, because it's in a ranking these online board tournaments. That maybe, so it seems like they're really good female players typically are American. I'm trying to think if that means that they wouldn't, because they're American, they wouldn't have the reach as a Swiss person would.
Mm.
I don't know. I don't know how to. I'm just trying to think, because obviously the thing that just comes to mind would be, you can just say sexism, right? But I mean, you can kind of almost say that everywhere, but I'm just trying to, trying to be comprehensive.
And especially since, like, from the studies that I've read, when you control for a lot of other things, sexism is essentially a 5% gap.
Yes. Not 5% p-value, but a 5%, like, usually a minor impact.
Right.
It's there, right? But, and I think that's very true of the economics, because some people try to make this argument saying, well, there is this unfair situation that has this, that happened in the past. Its persistence, right, is the reason why women cannot earn as much as men. Men won't watch women because they're latently sexist, right? And I think we kind of prove, you know, more and more that, you know, when there's compelling things to watch, men will watch because it's a compelling sport to watch, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that maybe there's some physical differences why, you know. I don't think that the WNBA lags behind the NBA because of sexism. I think it's because watching, and because it's new, right? I get that too, but because, let's say, watching that sport is not as compelling as watching the NBA.
Right.
I think there really is a quality difference there outside of just simply being men versus women. But to answer that question, is trying to think of why. I just don't know if I know.
Okay. I mean, that's fair.
Yeah, well, I'm just trying to think, because, you know, with Serena, when you think of Serena, it's Serena Williams. She's incredibly athletic. I don't know if she's, but even if it's attractiveness, maybe that's still sexism, but I don't know if she's necessarily, maybe it's because athletic men and athletic women aren't necessarily viewed as attractive, right? And maybe because, even though Serena Williams is a great tennis player, because she's not particularly attractive, versus men don't get penalized for not necessarily being particularly attractive as much, and therefore...
And that happens in society at large, right? Like, men are less penalized for being less attractive.
Yes, but I guess I don't know why. But then you could argue that there should be a bunch of lower quality, super attractive females that should be making bank.
Or at least...
Right, or...
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I think you're right. I think that there's... Like, you've got some interaction. Like, it's an interaction term, and then...
Yes. Between quality and attractiveness.
Right. But maybe quality has a bigger impact to a certain point, right?
Yeah, it would be... It would actually be an interaction term between gender, quality, and attractiveness, right?
Yeah.
What you're saying, how those would be, that actually would be different, right? Even.
Or yeah, maybe there's, it could be that they're separately considered, and that each one has a different weight, and then there's some second order effects on quality, right?
Yeah.
So you don't. Until you get to a certain point, you're just, no matter how attractive you are, you're not going to get the sponsorship.
Yeah, and that's interesting, because what do you think, and there's also other variables that, you know, like for example, you think of, let's say, what makes someone marketable? Is it really Serena's ability or someone's ability, or is it the visibility that comes from high ability, right? And it's because you're highly visible, people want you to, let's say, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
I mean, there's mm-hmm. there's other factors. It's not just simply that. Like, for example, let's say in baseball, maybe the best baseball player, not very visible this year, right? But even though he's the best baseball player for the year, maybe that person still can't leverage that into sponsorships simply because they're mostly the visibility component.
Right.
For some reason, right? Mm-hmm. You know. But what was your original question on that? I feel like I'm riffing, but
I have no idea. I think, I was asking about the difference in sponsorship between genders.
Yeah, and men are far greater than women.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's even much more so than, let's say, the relative demand of the sports, right?
Yeah.
Is what you're saying. It's like, given the relative demand, this disparity shouldn't be this big. I don't know. Is there potential concentration differences that there's fewer men who win all the tournaments versus maybe for women it's more dispersed for the top tournaments?
Yeah, I think that's...
But then again, that would change an individual. That's the dispersion, not necessarily the overall pie. Is it?
Right.
Unless that plays a role. I can, yeah. Outside, I'm trying to think of something outside of just sexism argument.
Right.
And honestly, it could be that. It just, because probably the buyers of a lot of these luxury items tend to be men, right?
And right. Probably, I mean, based on demographics that I've seen, older men, yeah. Because the population that's tennis fans is richer, they're also older. I think the average age for what I just saw in France is like 42,
okay.
For a tennis fan. So,
and maybe they're not thinking about, because you think about the products that like a Serena Williams would sell be more like female jewelry, right? And
right.
Maybe they're not buying that. Because you think part of it would be that, well, that would still work if they're married and they want to buy nice things, and maybe that would resonate, but maybe that disconnect doesn't work like that.
Yeah. Okay. What about, so in comparison with other sports, how do you think tennis compares in terms of like revenue streams? Like, I think from what I've found, at least the major Grand Slams, they get almost half their money from ticket sales and broadcasts, with the exception of the French Open, which is doesn't quite make as much in broadcasts, so it's not quite half if you combine them.
Okay.
But I feel like for the lower tier tournaments, it's got to be mostly ticket sales.
Sure.
Because there's not a lot of
only thing I could think of would be sponsorships of the tournament, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
You know, we can slap a Wells Fargo.
Right, and so for those lower tier tournaments, we did get asked this question. They get ticket sales, and they actually have to chase down their own sponsors. It's not like just because you're an ATP tournament, you can go ask the ATP sponsors. You have to find your own for your tournament.
Okay, but they got to find their own. But it sounds like they're successful on some level, right? People will give them money.
People do give them money, yeah. I mean,
it's just not...
I mean, they may break even on the tournament, I guess. Yeah. But then, like, how does that compare to, at least by your knowledge, to, like, other sports, like football or baseball?
Okay, so, you know, that's a great question, because I would say within the last 30 years, there's really been this big sea change where broadcast revenue is now the dominant... is now the dominant revenue stream, because really, ticket revenue was the dominant stream, and I think, like, people would talk about TV revenue and things like that. They've been talking it for as long as we've been alive, but ticket revenue has still been a very huge component, and only recently has it started to really be outpaced by, let's say, broadcast revenue and things mm-hmm. like that. Now, if I remember from the NFL, I think 60% of their revenues, I have that information, I can dig it up for you, but it was something like 60% of their revenues is not broadcast. Like 50 to 60%. Ticket sales is pushing out 20, 30, and then everything else is like merchandise.
Merchandise. Yeah. So merchandise is pretty huge.
Yeah, I believe so. And with the NFL...
I mean, that makes sense. $100 jersey, right?
Like, sure. And especially with the NFL, versus the other leagues, there's way more sharing within the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
Now... Actually, it's funny because Jerry Jones is the main reason why some of that has eroded. Like some of the merchandise sales for the Cowboys, he just simply gets the pocket, right? And I think too, a lot of the stadium specific revenue, like when they sell, when an owner, let's say, makes revenue by selling, it's the, like the general tickets, it's all shared revenue, but the boxes, luxury boxes, that's all revenue that's kept by the owner.
Okay. Right? Which is why they put so much emphasis on the boxes.
Yes. Right. Okay. In fact, all the new stadiums that you see nowadays, it's like the general seating is becoming almost smaller. It's just the boxes are just, you know, huge now. There's so many more of them, and that's why. Now, I think even then, in the latest agreement, they decided to share more of that box revenue, right, than before. But it used to be none of it was, right? And that's when, especially when they built, let's say, Cowboy Stadium or AT&T Stadium, right? That was not the case, and that was probably a big impetus for Jones saying, hey, let's go ahead and build this. Okay, Arlington, I'll get what I can out of Arlington, right? But I still want this thing built. I'm still willing to push in $700-800 million of my own money to get it done just so I can have those boxes and keep that.
Right.
And so it's definitely, compared to those other leagues, the broadcast money, I would have to believe, is much, much more versus the ticket. The ticket is still, you know, like dominant in that. But the ticket, like even in college football, ticket sales are still a big, big, big component, right? It's
okay.
Right. That's why you see, I think, so many, that's why there's been such a big reluctance in college football to really change from, you know, college football kind of has this tag where there's a lot of, let's say, cream puff teams that really powerful teams play, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and people, and I think people mistakenly accuse that of just simply saying, oh, they just want to get the easy win. I think they just want to have the home game. Because they know that, look, we will make, if we're Alabama, we make more by having the cream puff, paying the $500,000 to have the cream puff come here to our stadium and hold on to that ticket revenue versus, say, schedule a legitimate high-profile component. Now, granted, we would still get a benefit because it would be broadcast on TV and the conference would get this kickback, blah, 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 blah. But our share, that kickback that goes to the conference that has to be shared, is less than the big boon that we would get because we get one more additional home game every 2 years.
Okay.
Right? I think they're just being profit maximizing. This is a profit maximizing decision, not.
And the win obviously helps because, like, it helps in the slightly in the rankings, but.
Yeah, but I would argue even if it didn't, even if that win played no role in terms of their potential to make, let's say, the college football playoff or do a better bowl or anything like that, I still think that practice would be there because they would want to have that extra.
They want that home game.
So ticket sales, and, you know, the moral of the story is that ticket sales, while diminished in a lot of people's minds, I think plays a much bigger role than people view it as.
Okay, so
maybe not dominant, but
so tennis isn't that different then, because they're probably doing 30% ticket sales. The big tournaments are doing 30% ticket sales, 30%. Maybe even 35% ticket sales and revenue, or and broadcast revenue, and then it's like 23% and 15% for sponsorships and merchandise sales.
The one other thing to mention about ticket sales too is that there is this increasing, I guess, realization, and that ticket sales and, let's say, concession sales, obviously are complementary, right? You're going to get more concession sales with more ticket sales. And I think that interplay of them plays a bigger role than maybe what it played before, realizing that, okay, maybe the ticket sales plays one part of the role, but, you know, when it comes to what can we do to increase the price of ticket sales, but making sure that people who are still buying those tickets are the types who would still consume a lot of concessions as well, right? And that maybe they realize, I don't know how can anyone like this, but if they're increasing the price, that means you're probably losing some of the lower income individuals who can no longer go to, say, a Texas Ranger game.
Yep.
But maybe losing those lower individuals isn't quite as damning for the Texas Rangers, because those would be people who would be far less likely to buy a lot of concessions. And so you're still holding on to those high concession, you know, types. You know,
right.
And they're still willing to pay that higher price, and so maybe that justifies in some sort of way
to keep that
system going. That makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Where they can kind of get away with it more versus if there was a big hit in concession sales and they did raise ticket prices, maybe they'd be less reluctant to do that.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point. That you for ticket prices, you also have to balance that. I wonder. The problem is I don't think anyone's tried to do this sort of experiment, but I would wonder what the price elasticity of tennis tickets is to those big events. It has to be fairly low, though, because
the secondary market that second deck higher prices. Yeah. Yeah, that makes me think that at that price point. Yeah,
yeah, it's like if the secondary market can you know make the ticket price 10 times, 20 times its face value, then I mean you.
True. I mean, you always have to be a little bit careful looking at it, because if you think of the distribution of people that are out there, right, and right, because not everyone, it's not like you're going to get a stadium filled with people who pay $20,000
for a ticket,
right?
Absolutely
it's almost a way of reaching a consumer where, I guess, I don't know, maybe they didn't, that's hard to say. It's hard to say. It's hard to determine how much we should really look at those numbers from the secondary market as... If they were to price right at that 20,000 point, could they really get away with it?
Think they could. I think that if you were going to try and almost eliminate the secondary market, you'd probably price at about 75% of what they're pricing at. That way, like,
yeah,
because
they can't price discriminate. Right, so they can't just go to the high value consumers and force them to charge a higher price.
Yeah,
I mean, they discriminate based on the seat location.
Right. Well, they could. But it would be, I think, a nightmare, because you could put them up for auction. You could just set all your tickets to auction and then sell them that way.
Yeah. Okay. Sure.
But that'd be a nightmare in coordination and everything. But that would be, I think, one of the easier ways to get the maximum level of price discrimination maximization out.
Yeah, they could do it. Yeah, you're right, they could do an auction. It would be kind of interesting what kind of auction they would, just like you could almost look at it from you could do like what they call the Dutch auction, right, where you start at the higher price, right, and then they slowly go down. And then you can think of the consumers, as long as they can't collude, right? The consumers would be like, when it gets to a price point, they may be like, well, I really want to buy it here because I'm worried I'm not going to have anything left. And that'd be interesting if they could do that. Then you have certain people who would buy it. And some would be really nervous about it at the high price, right? And then you just kind of keep on going down until it's done, right? And then,
yeah.
That's interesting. Okay.
That would be an interesting thing to do. I don't think we'll ever get a tournament to do that, but
and it probably would be, you really would have to kind of be worried about what kind of coordination those consumers would have, I think the same thing about those secondary markets, that there's got to be, they're still underselling the price, it seems like, based off of that,
right?
That they're
not talking about tennis tournaments, I'm also looking at the size of the tennis industry, and so there's the Tennis Industry Association here in the United States, and they estimate that it's growing at like 1%, maybe 1.2% a year, which means it's actually shrinking relative to the
population growth
to the economy, right? Because the economy is at 2% growth and you're at 1.2. Sure. And so one of the things that I've seen, it's funny, they don't talk about it in the report, but the sales for tennis rackets, wholesale sales, is down, like, say, 7% year over year. But then the value of that is only down, say, 4% year over year. So I'm like, oh, well, what's happening is the wholesale price is coming up to compensate a little bit for these lower volumes.
Okay, yes.
But no one's saying that, like, oh, tennis racket prices are going up. I'm like, well, they kind of have to be if you're not getting a percent for percent drop in orders and amount and revenue, right?
Okay. Yes. Okay.
So you could possibly see that in ticket sales too. I'm just thinking about college football. They could be getting less attendance, but they could be making more because they're raising the prices.
Oh yeah, no, I think that's actually that's exactly what they're doing, right? Yeah, that they're raising prices, and that's they're willing to accept the fact that they have
fewer, smaller attendance, simply based on the fact that they're behaving more like a monopolist on the raising prices.
Right.
Right. And maybe it has to do with, you know, maybe way back when they were worried about concession sales too, and maybe they kind of realized that, well, when you do raise prices, the people who are no longer attending, you know, on the margin, are the people who are maybe spending very much on concessions anyway, so you don't have to worry about this complimentary. Maybe this complimentary
right.
isn't nearly as strong as maybe what you think, so you can get away with raising those ticket prices.
Right, because what they're worried about is people substituting ticket price for concession. But even then, I wouldn't worry about that, because the ticket price is more, like, with a concession, I have a cost to the, like, if you're spending an extra $5 on nachos, okay, well, it cost me, you know, something marginal, 25 cents to make the nachos, but if I just raise the ticket price $5, I get 100% of that, not, you know, the 85% of that or whatever.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I was thinking.
Like, why would you care about lower concession sales? You got all of the money.
Yeah, no, you're right. yeah, you're right, because then there's no. Because you're right, all the costs are fixed when it comes to tickets. So
yeah.
Regardless of whatever you sell, it's any additional ticket, your marginal cost is zero.
Yeah, your marginal cost is zero. You've sold. Yeah, you get the whole thing. So.
No, that's interesting, because I'm thinking this complimentary with concessions matters for the event, but it, you know, the secondary market doesn't care, right? Like, it's
yeah.
It's not like they can behave that way, but at the same time, you know, the secondary market is maybe more of a market than I give credit for. Because when you say secondary market, it's just often things like StubHub, right?
And
I guess those are, I mean, the prices that come from things like that are determined by individuals, right? And so, yeah, I don't know.
And then I don't want to sound like conspiracy theorists here, but then there could be the angle that to avoid that stigma of seeming elitist or monopolist, that it is actually the venue itself reselling the tickets on the secondary market. They've just essentially sold them to themselves and then saying, hey, they're being resold by X person, but it's really the venue itself.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, that's...
As in, they think that might be, like, an option for them?
Yeah, because they could, like, they essentially make fake accounts on StubHub or whatever, sell themselves the tickets. Sell being in quotes, like, they don't really have to sell them. And then
people
will pay what they want for those tickets, and then it's kind of a win-win, except you lose some of that revenue to the secondary market person,
yeah,
whether that's
a chunk of it, right?
Right, or Ticketmaster, whoever's doing that. But
I just don't wonder. Do you think part of this is a bit of the devil that they don't know, that they're just worried that if they do try to just raise their prices, that oh my gosh, all of a sudden are
I think they are worried about that.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's their biggest concern, is that if they raise their prices, if they feel like
this stigma.
Yeah, the stigma and this, you know, backlash, well, no one's going to buy tickets. I think they're worried about that.
Right. And honestly, I guess I get it. I do. Right.
Right.
Even though, as an economist, I don't think people should be bothered by it, like they say. But I think as somebody who's kind of pretends they're human and have a human heart and all that, you can kind of see
right,
it,
you can,
right?
You can
how
get why.
Snowball, and, you know, you don't want to seem like you're not on the, I mean, maybe some herd mentality or something like that, where it's like, you know, well, it's got to be bad because I'm reading it's bad, even though the justification of it might not be that big of a deal, right?
Right.
But I can see that. I can see that. I would be really curious to see how responsive that is, and I guess they just kind of view it, we'll just keep on this, maybe 10% trajectory, right?
Right. I was like, it's hard to tell. It's hard to do that experiment, right? Because there's only four tournaments that really have that kind of following. Now, there's the other, like, high-level ATP tournaments that, and I keep bringing up the ATP, they're the men's, but that's who we have a sponsorship with. But we will be talking to the WTA as well. But the ATP 1000 series stuff is... You know, there's the Miami Open and Indian Wells, which is another tournament, and California. I don't know that they're televised. I also don't know that they're not. But even if they are, it's got to be like just on the Tennis Channel or something. Like, it's not going to be huge. They're not going to be doing $300 million in revenue.
Do you know what I think might play a role in this? Is that, you know, when it comes to football, ticket prices, the face value of ticket prices aren't or isn't for NFL that crazy. But you know how they have personal seat licenses, right? It's a form of a, second degree price discrimination, right? Or it's not third for sure. But anyway, that's probably a combination of second and first, but. So, it's funny because the NFL doesn't seem to necessarily have that stigma as much. There are some people who complain about the cost, but
There are people that complain about the cost, but nobody's going, "Oh, I had to spend $1,000 on a ticket."
But they gouge, if you want to use gouge, by pricing the. I mean, they gouge in the sense. The theory is that they gouge in the sense of charging the licensee fee. Is basically with all the consumer surplus of the product, and then they typically would charge price the same level as, let's say, marginal cost, right? That's the theory how it would go. Now, that's not exactly what happens because the price is higher than marginal cost, almost assuredly, but it's just that, you charge the huge pool of money for the right to buy the tickets, and then the ticket prices are basically really, really, really cheap, right? And I wonder if for some reason people view that as much more palatable. Right? Maybe now that it's been here for a while, but that's more palatable versus just simply directly charging higher prices at, let's say, the tennis event, and that for some reason resonates with people versus if they're thinking about a way to, let's say, increase their amount of revenue. I don't know if that would work on the single event.
Actually,
like
I think
that.
They already. I think the U.S. Open or Wimbledon, one of the two, already treats tickets like season ticket holder things. Like if you went to the last one, you. Get, I guess, dibs on buying seats again, so it's like the licensing thing. So
okay, because the Panthers and Ericsson Stadium was the first one who did that right when they started, right? So they were the ones who said, well, okay, if you want these tickets, you have to pay the licensee fee, and then here's the actual cost per ticket, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what, and you're right, it doesn't seem like the NFL, it's like that's just simply more tolerated. Like, you'll see an article or two about it, but it's like, because it's not directly the ticket price, that disconnects enough.
Right.
You don't have these widespread, protests and.
Right.
You know.
There's not people going, Well, and then football, I don't think, has ever, seemed to be an elitist sport.
No. I say no, but I meant yes. I agree.
Yeah.
especially the NFL. If anything, has more of a moniker of being more blue collar,
right?
Than let's say college, right? Where college tends to be viewed as a little more highfalutin, even though the overall size and revenue numbers are way different, right? But it's I agree.
So then, I mean, since they've never had to deal with that, and part of this is tennis's own doing with Wimbledon, and their strict guidelines on how things can be presented.
Yeah.
For example, all the players have to wear white uniforms, and even I learned this recently, the logos for the sponsors are all in white and aren't very big. They're all of a certain small size.
Yeah.
So,
ooh, sorry.
That's all right. So that could be why tennis is really worried about it, because they know they have a richer audience. They know they're perceived as, you have to be kind of rich to enjoy the sport or play the sport. What they're worried about, I guess, is future tennis fans being turned off by that sort of message. Because they could milk the people that are already fans for all they're worth, but then the problem would be 20 years from now, nobody's showing up.
Is the concern that they think that the... is the concern that they think, let's say, the kids of the rich individuals don't want that association of this being, a rich sport, right? Is that what they're... Because I think they're probably not worried about the wealthy now, right?
Yeah, they're worried about... So,
or are they? Are they worried that there'd be this big backlash?
No, I think they're more worried about, say, generationally, younger people have a dimmer view of the wealthy, right? And things associated with
wealthy. Do the wealthy young also have a dimmer view?
I think so. I think
right.
It's
that's right. And that almost seems like what that would be concerning.
Right. And I think it's kind of universal, like, or and it may be less pronounced for the wealthy young than it is for everyone else, but I think it's still, like,
sure,
happening. So they don't want the sport to decrease in popularity.
But they're right, though. I mean, it's funny how these attachments are almost kind of made, right?
Yeah.
That branding attachment, but yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. Do they know how much crossover they do have? Like we look at things like intergenerational income mobility, looking at how a child that was, let's say, raised poor, how easy it is for that child to, let's say, move up the income stratum.
Right, economic mobility.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, those sort of things. And I wonder if you could almost have something like that for, let's say, the product, like how much... I think there's like a transition matrix of mine I'm envisioning here, right? But it's like, you know, somebody who's raised poor, let's say raised poor without much tennis exposure, how much if there is, let's say, a number of people who just simply, let's say when they're younger and maybe get wealthier, if those people will start liking tennis or something like that, right?
Right. And
it's
that's
almost like, what's the gateway
so
to tennis fandom? That's,
yeah, we're putting out a survey to answer these kinds of questions.
Yeah, but you already said that, didn't you? Where you said the gateway to tennis demand is through playing tennis, right?
Yeah, and the gateway to playing tennis is essentially through your parents. It's almost like a religion. Like, I know I'm in the minority in that I play tennis and my parents did not. And the only reason is, but my parents are still the reason. It's that during like one summer, my parents didn't want to have to pay for childcare, and they're like, "Hey, we lived across the street from a park," and they're like, "The recreation center has a tennis team for kids, so go over there and do that for the first half of the day, and then come home."
Yeah.
So that's how I started playing tennis.
Sure.
But I know for most people, it's their parents played tennis and taught it to them, and then just it keeps going that way. So you can't really. You can't afford to have people leave the sport because you need people to introduce
it. Well, it just makes it, that much worse, right?
Yeah.
And is there anything that, are people substituting out of tennis for something else that's been, especially something that I may be missing where, you know, maybe more and more people are substituting out of tennis for some other activity as, like, what's...
So there is some of that, and I don't know how much it's substitution, and that's a question I maybe will be able to answer, is that there are some newer racket sports that tennis facilities are kind of like reorganizing some of their courts to facilitate because these sports are becoming more popular.
Okay, all right.
And for example, this isn't a sport, but there's this thing called cardio tennis, which is essentially just tennis practice. Like when I read, I was like, "What is cardio tennis?" And it's apparently just someone running a tennis practice, and you're just doing all the drills like a bunch, and you're not actually playing any tennis, but you're getting exercise out of it. But that seems to be getting a lot more popular, especially here in the United States.
Huh. Interesting.
For other sports. Because that was something that was in that state of tennis industry from the Tennis Industry Association, is that they said that there was another like 4% drain on core tennis players from 2017 to 2018. And it's been kind of a steady decline in tennis participation since 2010. But they didn't really say why. And what I was really more interested in was, how do you know? How do you know that you've got, I think they said something like 4 million. No, it can't be 4 million more. I guess it was 4%. I'm like, how do you know you've had this many leave and this many come in?
Okay.
Like, how would you determine that? Because it's easy to determine, like, we had this many, like, this was a change in participation, but how do you know you had this many come in and had this many leave?
Yeah,
because that's the...
like where the net was.
Yeah.
Like a negative number or something like that.
Right. Because it's easy to tell you what the net was because
sure.
you can just measure.
Yeah, yeah.
But how would
how do you get to that number? Is it like two huge numbers, tons of people increase,
yeah.
or tons of people enter, tons of people exit, or is it just like...
is it really tiny, right?
Yeah.
How do you know that? And I think we'll have to find a way to get an interview with those guys, but they might be pretty cagey because the kind of report that we're writing is the kind of report that they sell, so...
Okay.
So they might be like,
Yeah, I don't know. Proprietary.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess that's actually a good question for you. What sorts of questions would you ask fans? What would you be interested to find out?
What's my goal here exactly? Like what the... like, am I trying to build a demand function?
I mean, that might be interesting. Because here's the thing. Right now, I don't have an overarching goal other than here's the state of tennis worldwide,
yeah.
and here are some interesting things. For example, here are the number of courts in each of these major countries. Here's how the population of tennis participation is changing. Here's how that relates to tennis ball and tennis racket sales, that sort of thing. And here's the economics of, professional tennis.
Sure.
And how, fans pay or buy things from sponsors. Sponsors pay media companies for rights for sponsorship on the broadcasts, and those broadcasters pay the event organizers, and organizers pay the players, and so.
Yeah, so like thinking of a survey, I think something that would maybe be interesting
mm-hmm.
would be, one thing you could do is maybe do some sort of, let's say, analysis of a, let's see, what are the factors that like matter the most. I'm just thinking of, let's say, building a demand function of, let's say, interest in tennis, right? Or like
okay.
to a tennis event. And just thinking about all the different things that would affect demand, right? Like now some of them, price plays a role here too, but looking at those factors outside of price that would shift a demand function, right? Like number of buyers, probably can't do too much about that, but let's say relative incomes, right? Like, I'm pretty confident we could probably say tennis is a normal good, right? That
mm-hmm.
as people's incomes increase, right, the the interest in tennis, the consumption of tennis increases as well.
Right.
Yeah. And so you think of, let's say, incomes, and try to get a responsiveness of, let's say, incomes to likelihood of attending an event, right?
Right.
We'd probably need a dependent variable, which would be how many they actually attended. Right.
Right. Which is, I don't have the budget for a huge response. So the people we're using are going to get us 3,000 survey responses, but it's going to cost like 40 grand.
Whoa. Okay.
But it's worldwide.
Okay.
And it's going to probably be about 800 from the US, and the smallest ones would be about 200 from China and 200 from India.
And this would be somewhat weighted based on, let's say, where like income levels would be, or would this, I mean, this isn't just going to be a random sample of world population. This is going to be,
I don't know.
Weighted towards
I don't know how they get survey responses. I think it's going to be more about like a general like survey that's it could the income distribution should be relatively the same as the income distribution of the country, but because this is we used them on our last thing, which was about talent, but the survey went to like C level managers
yeah.
of
Thanks.
Yeah. So that was a more expensive survey. Well, cost us the same, but we only got 1,000 responses. Sure,
yeah. The cost for response.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just thinking of demand, just thinking, a question to get at, let's say, because you would have to somehow grab their dependent variable, right?
Right, and so here's the thing. Finding out how often they've attended tennis events would be, I think, pretty easy in the survey. Finding out their level of income would be more difficult.
You don't think they would elicit that, like they wouldn't elicit anything to you?
Right. I mean, in the survey question that I wrote, yeah, I thought I was just going to be surveying people in the United States. We were just going to buy an email list of tennis enthusiasts in the United States and send out a survey and expect a 1% response. And But since we'll be asking in different countries, I can't just put a text box and be like, what was...
Oh, okay.
Like, and so...
Well, then maybe you can ask things that would be, like, let's say, ask... Because I know in the experimental, they try to get around that by asking things like, well, how many rooms are in your home? Or how many bedrooms are in your house?
I see.
As a proxy to that.
Okay.
That this would be their relative... You're kind of accounting for things like price differences. So ask, well, how many bedrooms are in your house, right? And if they have like 6 or 7, that's probably pretty tightly correlated. I think there's probably, you know, and that would be something they would know right off the bat too, because sometimes people don't know income, which probably would be a big deal as long as they're not biased one way or the other, right? If they're not just simply low, if everyone lowballs, then you might have a bias problem, but if people are going to, you know, just as likely to say a number high versus low, then it's not a big deal. But
right.
But I know that's one way they get around that is that they ask for, like, let's say, like, number, maybe it's even number of bathrooms might be
okay.
A good measure too. That might even be a better measure than bedrooms. But let's say you ask that to kind of get a gauge of income, right? if you can't ask an income question, right?
Because that was one of the things I wanted to do was, like, I wanted to be able to correlate income with, I came up with this other idea about passion as far as a measurement of fandom, and that would be based on how often a person watched tennis and how likely and how often they went to a tennis tournament. And then I could correlate that with income and try and say, all right, well, more passionate people, regardless of income, do this, but yeah. Higher income also correlates with it. So if you can get this quadrant of people that are both passionate and high income, yeah. they might be worth more money to you.
Yeah, where the if they're a lower income person, if they're lower income but they attend a lot of events, then you can almost just kind of argue that those are for sure the passionate people.
Right.
Because at the higher income level and go to a lot of events, well, it's just because they just have higher income.
Right.
So it's hard to kind of gauge.
What I call the prestige fans.
Yeah.
Fans that would go because, like, oh, I went to the U.S. Open.
Sure,
but
sure.
They
and
didn't
maybe
really care
passionate
about
passionate ones would be there, too, if they're wealthy. But it's
right.
Just how do you... It's hard to disentangle the two different types.
Right.
Yeah. But, so going back on the demand component, we have, let's say, number of bathrooms or number of bedrooms as a proxy for income.
For income.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Then you want to get some sort of gauge of the marketplace, like how substitutable, if I don't go to Wimbledon, what would I do in my stead, right? Like what kind of, assuming that they kind of like these events, would they readily substitute out for another tennis event? Would they substitute out for, well, if I don't do this, I'll just go to a soccer match or something like that? Or you see what I'm saying? What are
right.
the substitutes?
What are the substitutes? Yeah.
Right? Ryan, won't you get a gauge of how many they would, like, they go to, the substitutes, maybe compliments, I can't think of anything.
Well, actually, so, oddly enough, that's something that Australian Open is doing, is they're trying to make it less of just a tennis event. I think they've also incorporated, like, a music festival
yeah.
at the same time.
Yeah.
As a way to draw in more people.
Sure, no, that makes sense. Yeah, I get it. It's especially if you think that it's the exposure that if I can just get these people, in front of a tennis match, I know.
Yeah, they'll be like, "Oh, hey, this is cool.
This is really interesting to watch."
Yeah.
No, I get it. But or at least the event in and of itself is fun to go to.
Right, and so that's the one of the questions we want to be asking. If I can find enough of them, the lower level tennis event organizers, how open or likely is it that they would
bundle with some
other cultural event?
Yeah, because it's not necessarily complimentary. Like, I think a complimentary is products that are typically, like, when I go to a concert, I don't think, oh, I'm not much more likely to go to a tennis event, right? But if you're using, but you could use it almost as a, not loss leader per se, but yeah, you're right, that maybe the, but you're kind of enhancing the whole shebang, aren't you, though?
Right. The idea is that you'll get exposure to both. And, but then the I don't know, the question in my mind becomes, okay, but you're cannibalizing the people that would have gone to both. But the question is, how likely is that? How likely is it that a person would have gone to both events had they been separate events?
Yes,
held at different times.
Or, like, I'm guessing they kind of view in a concert as, say they're viewing a concert as something that is to drive, the purpose of the concert is to drive people to pay the money to go see the tennis event, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think the bigger concern might be that, who are the people who would have went to the tennis event anyway, right? Where now they get to enjoy this concert from their standpoint almost for free,
right?
Because they're still paying the same price,
right,
that they're paying for it, right? And so, that would be, that would be tough. But, I mean, you're thinking along the lines that if you do charge a higher price and you try to bundle it,
now
it's relatively inelastic, it might not be a big deal.
Right, and you've got a reasonable explanation for why prices have gone up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right. Like, we're offering this now.
Yeah, if you're trying to also kind of eliminate the secondary market.
Yes, great point. And that could be your vehicle to do that. That's a great point.
French Open can't. They don't have enough space. But it could be something that, and
Irving certainly probably could.
That's what I'm thinking. Is it for that. for the smaller tournaments? They probably do have space, and they could absolutely. But then again, I don't think there's a secondary market for tickets to go to the Irving.
Yeah. No. True. But if they're worried about thinking that reach, right? That exposure to it will increase the demand for the sport in and of itself. Maybe they can use that as a vehicle to at least increase the exposure of the sport.
Right.
Saying that, maybe there's some people who will want to go to the concert, or maybe they kind of view it as more of a comprehensive good time, and maybe they would go,
right,
and, okay, let's check out tennis.
Yeah, it's like, it's now a cultural event, and it's got this, this, and this. Like, it's got these things going on.
Sure.
Yeah, that's one of the things I wanted to ask those folks. But you're thinking something interesting would be to try and build a demand curve for tennis.
Oh, or at least trying to figure out, if not build a demand curve, at least try to figure out what seemed to be, because, we talk about all these things that shift demand, mm-hmm, and we talk about them kind of generally, right?
Mm-hmm.
If consumers are, let's say, highly elastic, well, changes in income may be the dominant factor, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, thinking about one standard deviation change in the increase of income, what would be its effect on the standard deviation change on, let's say, your dependent variable of the amount of events that they're going to go to,
right?
Or their likelihood to go to an event or something like that, right? Versus, say, if you look at your responses, a one standard deviation change in, the price of a substitute, right? I mean, that's hard to do. I know that's hard to do, but you know what I'm saying? To try to get,
right,
which is a truly dominant factor.
It's like, what I'm really worried about is, like, the, while I already feel like I have a small sample size problem, then I make it worse by trying to measure the number of events somebody goes to, because unless you live near a big, like a lucky city, I guess, there's only going to be one event a year.
Mm-hmm.
if that. So it, like, yeah, just depending on. So yeah, and I for mean, example,
you can probably proxy that with population, maybe of the.
For example, India has literally one tournament that's in the ATP Challenger or non-challenger, like anywhere in there. Mm-hmm. Whereas the U.S. probably has 20.
Okay, yeah. And so how do you say that? Maybe people didn't even be very responsive to it, but the likelihood of them being able to, yeah.
Yeah, being able to actually go is very low.
Sure. I mean, I guess you could ask them if there was local tennis
event. If there was a local tennis right. event, how likely would you be to? Okay, that's not bad.
Attend. I mean, whenever you solicit that, whenever you're soliciting, you have to think of okay, what kind of price do they have in mind, right? Because if you're asking how many are they actually going to, versus how many would they go to, you almost kind of have to think of.
Mm-hmm.
They have some sort of.
They'll price have a price in their mind.
In their
you're,
mind,
absolutely.
Resources. So you almost have to kind of think about
how to tease that out
how
too.
How to get that out, yeah.
Okay, because I remember that Dr. Ward had a. I took his classes at one of his classes in an undergrad, and he had us give prices for songs, like how much we would pay for it,
mm-hmm.
and for me, for most of them, I was like, I'd pay maybe a dime or a nickel. Yeah. Oddly enough. Most people were willing to pay more because the data showed that the average was about $1 a song, which is what iTunes was paying
yeah.
or was asking for at the time. I'm like, I wouldn't pay more than 15 cents for this song.
Sure. Well, yeah. But I know. Yeah.
But yeah, I was very surprised. So yes.
Yeah, I can believe that.
Teasing out the price.
Yeah, I don't know. Some people do that. I know estimating demand is really, really tough stuff. It usually requires like a two-stage estimation process. Maybe even Ward went over that, right? How maybe you think of price. You have a first stage where you address things on price, and then what you do is that then you have like a proxy price variable there that you can then substitute into your model where quantity is now your dependent variable, but then you have this estimated price variable in it, and it has to do with the fact that you're controlling for something that could cause you a bias problem down the road, and then to actually get, let's say, unbiased results. And Dave, you're talking about instrument variables?
Oh, yeah, we talked about... Well,
we did?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Like, use mother's and father's education level
yeah.
to predict college attendance or whatever.
Yeah, and then because they try to get out wages from, like, education,
yeah.
right, is usually
yep.
the big one there, yeah. And like for prices and quantity, it's a simultaneous. They're both. The issue there is that price affects quantity, but
quantity
also affects
price, right?
And so you have to disentangle the two because they're endogenous to one another.
Right.
They're causal. It's the causality there is circular, and so you
yeah.
have to try to use variables like an estimate price that don't play a role in terms of estimating, let's say, quantity and that.
Right.
That's very confusing.
Yep.
Okay, very good.
All right. I think that's probably enough for now.
Okay, yeah, no problem. No problem. I'll say I got
another thing. I've definitely got